Sheltering in place from San Francisco's Excelsior District, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we'll get an update on the coronavirus from a Nobel laureate who worked with the WHO and the United Nations. Also, we'll speak with the San Francisco Board Supervisor on how the shelter-in-place order is working for the elderly and those with special needs. Also, Trump wants to close the U.S.-Mexico border. What are the implications for those asylum seekers fleeing the violence in Central America? And we'll have a report on South Korea and why they have been so much more successful than the U.S. in dealing with this pandemic. All this coming up straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, the coronavirus has spread to all 50 states with thousands of confirmed cases across the nation and a death toll that exceeds 100 now. In an effort to prevent transmission, many localities have banned mass gatherings, shut down schools, and limited restaurants to takeout orders only. Here in San Francisco, the mayor has instituted a policy of shelter in place. And that's where we're going to start today's show. Joining us to talk about the lives of San Franciscans and how they've been affected, particularly the elderly and those most at risk, is the supervisor for the city's District 11. That's Asha Safi. Supervisor, thank you so much for taking the time out for us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm happy to be on the show.
Well, it's good to have you with us. How are you doing? Are you okay? Family okay?
Yeah, everyone's okay. Obviously, it's a big adjustment. You know, the kids found out that they weren't going to school on Monday. And already, we haven't told them that the governor said yesterday that most likely the schools are shut down for the rest of the school year until the fall. So that's a little bit jarring. But, you know, families that don't have resources, don't have alternatives, don't have the ability to help their children continue to learn, that's a big issue. And then, as you said, as you've invited me on the show, we're really concerned about seniors and those with additional, needs, most vulnerable populations. How are they going to get basic necessities like food and other basic necessities for their life to continue to go on? So we're working around the clock, my staff and I, and we're troubleshooting and we're doing everything we can to make this order work in the most humane way for everyone.
All right, and let's talk a little bit about, the mayor has declared a shelter in place. I've been in my apartment here for the last couple of weeks. I'm one of those over 70s and at risk in terms of immune system and stuff like that. Talk a little bit about if the shelter in place you think is working, effective, and are people, do you think they're educated enough about what the dangers are?
I think that it's amazing to me, actually. You know, I'm out in the morning, I'm out in the evening, I'm out in the middle of the day, you know, trying to get from A to B in a very safe way, but also kind of, you know, monitoring the city. And it's just, I've just been so impressed with how the majority of people are taking this so seriously and understanding what it means. There's still more education that needs to happen. There's still, you see a lot of younger people still kind of roaming the streets, not believing that they're in any danger or any risk. But for the most part, businesses that need to be shut down are shut down. People that need to be staying in their house are staying in their house. And other than people getting from A to B to get to work that are deemed essential employees, it's happening. The things that are harder, it's about, how do we get food and basic necessities to people? How are we dealing with the homeless? How are we ensuring that we're getting them away from living in, congregate situations? How do we ensure that there is shelter? How do we get, groceries to seniors that are supposed to stay in their home and not go out at all, other than maybe to get a little bit of fresh air? So those are some of the, issues, and then you think about, monolingual families and undocumented families. You know, there's a lot of people that are going to need a lot of additional support. And so that's what we're doing. We're thinking about the most vulnerable and how we can help them during this time.
You mentioned the undocumented. We did a segment yesterday in terms of the Day Labor Center there in San Francisco, a little below your district. But number one, people don't have adequate medical care. And two, many are afraid, given we know San Francisco is a sanctuary city, and we know that the president has sort of called out the shock troops against a sanctuary city. So that's problematic. By the way, I
will say, like, I'm very happy that, like, even in my district, we have a clinic. There's multiple clinics in my district that serve undocumented. They serve everyone, but particularly those that have no insurance at all. And they have been made, anyone that has any health issues that could be related to this are being made high priority. And so that infrastructure is still remaining in place. So I'm happy that we have that service to offer.
Well, that's incredibly important, and I'm very glad to hear that. Of course, we're all on a learning curve on this one. We're learning a lot more. There are a lot more revelations about. We heard a lot about the transmission through the air and body fluids, wash your hands, and all that. But we're also learning now that this virus has the ability to stay on cardboard one day, on metal surfaces for up to 3 days. So we're all sort of learning about this situation. I'm wondering how we can think about making sure that people don't think that they know it all and that they can relax as long as they sort of stay indoors. What about, is there a need for more of an educational campaign?
Well, remember, this is just day three of our shelter in place. And already, you know, I think people are behaving, you know, just conforming incredibly to the situation. But of course, yeah, there needs to be more education. I mean, you know, when I see some of the food pantry lines and giveaway, people are still on top of one another. So people need to get out and understand what social distancing means. You know, I think we're educating and moving as quickly as we can under the circumstances. And we're going to continue to have to do that. 100%. You know, I was just, you know, reminding my staff, like, you gotta, you know, those that are in work, some of them are working from home, you know, you gotta keep your distance, you know, and it's a constant reminder. It's a constant reminder for a lot of people, for sure.
Now, I live in an apartment where I actually can see two bus lines passing right under my window. And, I counted the last 10 buses. I watched them go by, and six of the drivers were not wearing masks. Should they be wearing masks? Well, there's some confusion
you should only be wearing masks unless you're not well. Wearing a mask is not going to protect you from contracting any virus, really. It's really about when you wash, particularly in this, is about droplets on your hands, and you touch your eyes or your mouth, and then it's spread like that, or you convey it to somebody else by touching them and getting it on surfaces near them. So no, it's truly about, if you have it, then yes. And then the reason I say no is because there's only a certain mask, and these are really medical surgical masks that are a special type, and those are the ones that will help prevent you from inhaling any virus. But they're just the everyday masks. No, we're very lucky in San Francisco, I think you're in the East Bay, but in San Francisco, because of the way our city has evolved to deal with all different types of issues, our bus drivers have an enclosed area. They don't handle any money. They don't touch any, they're really isolated away from the passengers, so they're protected. But maybe, I don't know if it's like that over in Berkeley. They don't, here in San Francisco,
well,
they have their own.
Supervisor, sorry to interrupt, I am actually in your district San Francisco.
Yeah,
you are my representative well.
I got confused. So no, yes, so in San Francisco here, the way that the Muni works, the SFMTA works, is all of the drivers have their own enclosed area And so they're very protected in that regard. And I was on the head of, we were talking to the head of the SFMTA, Jeff Tumlin, last night. They clean the cars in the morning, they clean them at night, and now they're even going to be instituting sanitizing mid-shift. So he's increased that. The conductors, as I said, the drivers, operators don't touch any of the money. They're not handling things, and they're isolated away from the passengers. So they're in relatively good shape compared to any of their counterparts in other parts of the country.
Well, I must say, Supervisor, I know you do a good job in doing service and serving your community here. But as I say, I'm in the middle of it. But I'm wondering how this has changed the way that you and your staff offer service to the community, because that's a big part of your job. Has this been a life changer for you?
Absolutely. I mean, we're constantly on social media. We're giving everyone updates. I mean, we made ourselves available. Folks needed us to deliver, groceries to their house. We're out on the, people were calling in and saying that there were many businesses that were still remaining open. Information hadn't gotten to them yet. So we had to work with our police department and other city government to go out and kind of inform people which businesses were essential and which weren't. We're constantly fielding calls from constituents saying, should I go into the office? Should I not? Should my business be open? Should it not? I mean, this is a round-the-clock endeavor. We've been doing a lot of work also really with organized labor. A lot of the folks that live in District 11, the Excelsior Outer Mission, other parts of the district, OMI, we have the highest concentration of working families. So, I mean, I'm talking janitors, nurses, teachers, firefighters, construction workers, store clerks. We've been on the phone with every single one of those industries and conveying, what are the proper workplace protections for workers, bus drivers, as I already said to you, bus operators. We've been fielding and kind of maintaining and getting as much information and protections for workers right now as we can, because a lot of the affected industries, either that are working or not working, need to understand what their rights are, whether it's the city announced 5 additional days of unemployment insurance on top of the additional days that are there. Sick days on top of the initial sick days. And so that gives additional time to people. We're working on unemployment insurance. We're working with the state on some of the announcements. We've put forward 2 resolutions to ensure and push the banks and utilities not to cut off any utilities or impose any additional fees or foreclose on anyone. And then yesterday we did a resolution pushing Donald Trump and the executive branch along with Congress to give direct cash payments to every American citizen at around $5,000 for every 30 days that this crisis continues. I mean, people need to be able to continue to live. Otherwise, they won't be able to.
Absolutely.
So we're in overdrive mode. Absolutely.
And finally, back to where we started. Again, I'm in the over 70 category. I'm lucky. I'm a producer and a person who has young people working with me, showing me how all this technology works, keeping me apprised as what's going on. I'm wondering, how are you reaching out particularly to the elderly, to people who might not be as savvy with the technology, who might be a little bit lost? Go on. Yes.
What we did today is my office convened with the Chamber of Commerce, online conversation with grocers and pharmacies to understand what they're doing to accommodate seniors and more vulnerable populations. So we were on with Safeway, we were on with Whole Foods, we were on with BuyRite, we were on with Walgreens, and they all gave us their new schedules. Whole Foods is open 1 hour early every day for those seniors. Safeway is opened up early from opening time, in some cases 5 to 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. exclusively for seniors on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Walgreens is now doing with FedEx free delivery from the pharmacy. Safeway has delivery from the pharmacy, and Safeway is on a massive surge to hire delivery drivers, personal shoppers, and store clerks to staff up for this massive demand that's coming from people buying groceries and eating at home more than they would normally. So everyone is stepping up and doing their part. And so we're waiting. We're going to summarize that, and we're going to get that out on social media to the district. And for those that are not tech savvy, we'll have flyers and we'll distribute it through other networks that work with seniors. And if we have to go door to door to inform people, we will as well.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for taking the time out. I know this has been a very busy day, an incredibly busy and trying time for your work and the work that you do for the community. So we want to thank you for joining us, Supervisor, and we wish you the best and good health for your family and all that you love.
Thank you as well. And I'm sorry, I'm probably a little sleep deprived. I knew that you were a constituent of mine. So I appreciate it, Dennis.
Not a problem.
If I see you in the community, say hello. And if you ever need anything or want me back on the show, I'm happy to come back.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us on Flashpoints today.
All right. Thank you. You have a good night.
You too. And you are listening to Flashpoints. We've been speaking with Supervisor Asha Safi. That's the District 11 here in San Francisco. We are all now sheltering in place in the city. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about again about the undocumented, about what's happening at the border. Trump is threatening to close it down completely. He wanted it to happen today. There's been some resistance. We're going to talk about that after this musical break. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're now joined by Dr. Devra Davis. She is I believe the president of the Environmental Health Trust. She is an epidemiologist advising governments and policymakers. She has worked with the WHO, the United Nations, the IMF, and the Clinton administration. She won the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize on the team of IPCC scientists. Dr. Davis, it is good to have you with us. Thanks for joining.
Well, delighted to be with you.
All right. Well, things are moving very quickly. We're hearing more. I guess we're learning more about the nature of the virus. You worked with the WHO. We know that the Trump administration decided not to accept the tests coming from the WHO. There was some indication that that was because they were inferior and the United States wanted to develop their own tests. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in the United States, we have a long tradition of having to have it invented here to use things. And unfortunately, I think this is a situation where that might not have been the best decision. Normally, whether it's data on drug safety or safety of medical instruments and things of this sort, we always insist on our own tests, information. This is one instance where that basically gave us a delay of being able to have tests, and so now you have a situation where, although we believe we're going to be having access soon, we do not have adequate tests available. And because of that, all of the data that you hear about are the number of deaths we can be certain of, but the number of cases we really cannot be certain of.
We're sort of seeing a policy that's essentially an attempt at containment. If we can educate the population, do our best to contain, that's our best path forward. Do you think we're going in the right direction? What would you add to that? How would you look at this?
Well, I would say that we have no choice but to do what we're doing right now because the virus is threatening every person in this country. We have some new information out of Italy and Korea right now, by the way, that I think it's important for all of your listeners to know, which is that in the beginning, although it looked as though the millennials were exempt from exposure, we now have data in Korea and in Italy where cases have occurred in people in their 20s, and some of them have been quite serious. So it's
quite
not
serious.
Quite serious, including a few deaths. So it's not that people in their 20s don't get it or have no symptoms at all. In fact, on the contrary, there have been a number of cases where people in their 20s have not only gotten it but have died. And that's relatively new information, and it's important for everyone listening to understand that. Millennials are not immune from the effects of this virus, and therefore they really do have to take these precautions. They have to protect their parents and their grandparents, and they have to protect themselves as well.
I understand there's also been some studies, new information, that in fact the virus lasts longer than we thought on surfaces. My understanding is cardboard as long as one day, metal surfaces up to 3 days. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, these are laboratory data because that's all we can have in this circumstances, where tests were done of showing that the virus can stay alive and active, particularly on metal and on plastics, for a lot longer than we thought. And again, that's the reason why you have to understand that if someone has recently sneezed on a surface, that droplet that lands on that surface can remain active for far longer than we'd originally thought. And that's the reason why it's very important to understand there's a difference between cleaning and disinfecting. When you clean, you can wipe something off, but it can still, unfortunately, remain active. You have to disinfect. And there are some very simple things you can do to disinfect using sprays that you can make yourself with a simple solution. Their information is on this on the now is available through some of the State Health Department websites as well.
My understanding now is we're hearing a lot about how long is this going to go on? I've been sheltered in, I'm one of those over 70s with a compromised immune system. I've been in for a couple of weeks. We're hearing all kinds of reports. Some folks are saying, well, we have to see what's happening in 15 days. Some folks are suggesting that this could go on for months into May. Some people are saying 12 to 18 months that it could seem to get better and then come roaring back. Could you give us your best knowledge on that?
Well, again, I think generally the past allows us to predict what may be happening for the future, except that this is something that we've never seen in the world before. Never in the world before have we been so united by air travel in the way that we have. And as a consequence, the ability of this virus to spread has been pretty much without precedent. There's nothing quite like it. And yes, you're right. For the next 15 days, at least, it's really important that if people shut down, we may avoid becoming like Italy. And that is, in fact, the goal here. Italy.
Do you think that's possible?
I think it is possible. I absolutely think it's possible. But it's going to take every single person in this country being involved. We are, in that regard, at war with a virus. And I think that it's going to take concerted action. And that's why it's so important that people understand that each one of us has a role to play here.
We're hearing estimates now that if things don't go well, this could cost the United States a death rate of as up to 2 million people. Is that out of line?
Well,
is that ridiculous?
Imperial College London this week released an analysis in which they did a worst case assessment. And unfortunately, that's appropriate. What they did is they took the case fatality rate of China. Let me explain what that is. We know the number of cases that were evaluated in Wuhan, China, which was the center, the epicenter of this. And you can calculate of how many people who got the disease, what percent died. And that's a very, very important number. And at the same time, that number is going to go all over the place now because we are not doing a good enough job of testing. We do not have enough test kits. But in China, the death rate from this disease was extremely high. It was really close to 4%. And in some areas, it seemed to even be higher than that. And so what Imperial College London did, and they had some of the best and the brightest people in the world working on this, was to say if that case fatality rate, that is the number of people who die compared to those who get it, if that rate were to apply to the United States, how many people would die? Given what we also know about the contagion rate, which is how many people contracted for every one case that we know of. And that contagion rate, unfortunately, appears to be 2 to 3. And in China, it might even have been higher. So it's a worst-case analysis, but yes, it is true that if that worst-case analysis were to apply to the United States today, we could see 2 million deaths. I have reason to think that that will not be the case, and I've written that recently in U.S. News and World Report. I believe that there are several different reasons why we see this very unusual situation in China and Iran and, to some extent, Italy. First of all, we know that China and Iran have some of the highest rates of tobacco smoking in the world. Secondly, we know, and I know this because my husband and I have taught in some of the major cities in China, that the air pollution in Chinese cities today can be equivalent to smoking 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day just by breathing the air. I joked with my family that when I went there, I was in a 5-star prison because we could stay in a hotel that would have air filters in every room and almost never went out except to go to teach our classes. But most people in China don't have that luxury. And so as a consequence, just breathing the air, in normal air in China, can be like smoking 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day. In addition, we know that this area where this virus started in China is also one of the heaviest producers of steel in the country. And contrary to the United States, where we have rather stringent controls on air pollution, the Chinese have only recently instituted major national controls on air pollution. So they have worse air pollution, they have high rates of tobacco smoking, and they have one other thing that is hard to imagine if you haven't experienced it. Public toilets throughout China, whether it's a restaurant or a university, are often just a hole in the ground with plumbing around it, and you cannot put tissue into that plumbing. So if when you're finished using toilet tissue, if it's there, you then put it into a basket, which is often completely uncontrolled, and you get airborne E. coli, airborne hepatitis C, and in other words, airborne material that can be found in fecal material. That we know that. And those are contributing to very bad sanitation. And now, according to a recent study in The Lancet, we know that toddlers who have no symptoms of all at all of any exposure can excrete in their feces COVID-19 virus. So that becomes yet another source of transmission. And I believe that the poor public sanitation in China and Iran, the high levels of air pollution and the high levels of smoking might explain why they have the very, very high rates of dying from this virus. Having said that, you have the question, well, what about Italy? Well, it turns out that northern Italy does not have the same problems of sanitation, but it does have extremely high rates of tobacco smoking and very high rates of air pollution for the country in an area where, because of the peculiar meteorological formations and the mountains, there's often areas of where massive amounts of air pollution will stay stationary over Milan and related areas. And there's one other factor that's relevant to all of these places, and that has to do with diesel. Millions of trucks and cars that are on the roads in these areas all over the world are spewing out levels of diesel exhaust that are 40 to 100 times over what is approved in the United States. And the reason we know this is because the California Air Resources Control Board was able to expose the fact that starting in the mid to late 1980s and forward, diesel engine manufacturers created fraudulent diesel engines which, when they were hooked up to a computer, would appear to be perfectly clean in terms of their emissions. These were called defeater devices. But in fact, in the real world, not hooked up to computers, these engines spew huge amounts of pollution, 50 times smaller than a human hair. And this air pollution, again, in China, where they do a lot of diesel engines, as well as in Italy, can enter the lung, and sometimes, when it's small enough, get into the bloodstream, where it can compromise the immune system. The United States does have diesel engines, but not nearly as much as any of these other areas. So I'm not suggesting that we're off the hook, but what we know about the lungs and the nose is that their job is to get rid of bacteria and viruses. That's why it's so important not to smoke tobacco, and that's why it's so important, or to smoke anything that you burn, by the way, including weed. Smoking of anything will block the ability of the lungs and the nose to clear pollution. And chronic air pollution compromises the capacity of the lungs to do their job, which is to block the viruses and bacteria that come into our body normally. And when all of these things combine, massive sanitation problems, air pollution, smoking, and diesel engine exhaust could explain why there's more lethality, more danger to the virus in these other countries. And frankly, in Wuhan in particular, the market where this supposedly originated was a live animal and slaughter market. Now, you can imagine, you're selling live animals, the people then go home to kill, or sometimes they're killed on the spot, and then you have blood mixing in with all of that pollution in the area, and you have densities of population that it's hard to imagine. But I'll just give you one example. In some Chinese factories, it's not uncommon for workers to live there in the factory, and there can be 8 to 10 people sleeping in a single room.
Wow. Well, let's sort of stay on the subject, but change the country. Last night we did a segment on homelessness, and people, there's a growing, as you know, there's a growing number of homeless people in the United States. We were talking to a homeless activist and somebody who wasn't homeless, who works with the homeless, who has been struggling in Santa Cruz to get the local government there to provide toilets and various sanitation structures that they could deal with. And the local government there is not very responsive. Could that be problematic for local communities where you have a number of homeless folks who don't have proper toilets, proper places to clean up? Do you think this could be a problem?
Oh, there's no question about it, and I'm glad to see, you know, California has been leading the world when it comes to many things, and one of them is how to address this problem among the homeless. I know that the governor, Kaiser Permanente, has pledged money to try to treat the disease there, but I think the real treatment is prevention. The real treatment for homelessness is housing. And we know that that's a very complicated thing, and that this is a huge public health problem. I'm not smart enough to have the answer, but I know that The Lancet recently had an article talking about the fact that you cannot ignore that. You've got a population with poor nutrition and lots of other problems that have to be addressed now, because they can become, they themselves will suffer, but so will we all, because if anything's been made clear by this virus, it's that we are all in this together.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Devra Davis. She's an epidemiologist. She has advised governments and policymakers. She has worked with the WHO and the United Nations and the Clinton administration. She won the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize on the team of the IPCC scientists. She's a founding director of the Center for Environmental Oncology. She's now the president of the Environmental Trust. And obviously, we're talking about this virus. What is your response when you hear the President of the United States refer to this as a Chinese disease? You are mentioning that you know, the butchering in public of animals is problematic in China. It's not the only place where that happens. But what are your thoughts on labeling the disease that way?
Again, just like we don't have another planet to go to, we really don't have the we don't have the ability to say that this is a problem that's isolated to one segment of the world or one segment of our own population. And I think that if you look at the coronaviruses, which this is just one example of, there are many different types, and coronavirus has been around for a long, long time in various forms. There's the one called MERS, that stands for Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus, right? There's SARS, that's for South Asian Respiratory Virus. There's the Hong Kong flu. They are named for the place of their origin, as best we know. That's not unusual. But to call it the Chinese disease, I think, is a disservice. And we have to recognize that it may well, it originated in China. There's not much of a debate about that. But it's now around the world today. And it's our problem. It's not something we can say was caused by them, and therefore it's of no consequence to us. And in fact, China is suffering more than any other country. What we have to pay attention to is the change in the rate of acceleration of the virus. That's the good news coming out of China. The good news is that because of the fairly draconian things that they did there, and this involved not just mandatory shutdowns like you're seeing now in the Bay Area, but policing, and people were removed from their homes and put into fever clinics where they stood by while they waited for test results, and then, if need be, put into more serious hospitals. Those are the things that we have to pay attention to, and not the fact that this originated in this live animal market in Hebei, Wuhan, China. It's irrelevant right now where it originated. What is relevant is what can we do to slow the pace of the spread. The term that you're hearing in the media is to flatten the curve. You know what that means is that there's a normal steep slope for recording numbers of cases of this that's going on all over the world today. How steep is that slope? Well, unfortunately, in Italy, it was so steep that they swamped the ability of hospitals and doctors to even evaluate this. And we want to not have that happen in the United States, because if you think right now listening that you might have this virus, do not go to the emergency room. Do not go to the hospital. Pick up the phone, have a friend of yours call or contact a health professional, and they will tell you what to do and where to go. Because what hospitals and emergency rooms are places for the sickest of all people, and if you show up there and you are shedding this virus, you can sicken hundreds and potentially thousands of healthcare workers. And it's the healthcare workers, it's the nurses in particular, who are on the front lines, who are really helping all of us. And if we sicken them because people are going in and they're not adequately protected, then we're going to really worsen this, and we will end up, unfortunately, looking like Italy. I should say my organization is Environmental Health Trust, and we're working with Dr. Robert Morris, who is an MD, PhD in epidemiology, and he has a blog from Seattle, which he calls Ground Zero, Notes from Seattle, where he talks about what's being disclosed every day in this area, where they basically, it's like being in Ground Zero, because he and his family live very close to the nursing home where this originated. And still, it's important to realize this originated in the United States in this nursing home, and the conditions of the nursing home were ideal for transmission of this infectious agent. Fortunately, most of us don't live in nursing homes. And it was because people were in a nursing home and because there was no awareness of the highly contagious nature of this virus that it spread so rapidly among these people.
Ari, how would you compare and contrast the way in which the United States has dealt with this issue, say, to South Korea?
Well, I don't know enough about Korea, but I will tell you one thing about Korea that I do know, and that is that they've recently analyzed their data on the infection rate in the 20 to 29-year-olds, and they have found that they have a very relatively high rate, again, among millennials. And so they've now, moving forward, they are paying attention to that and trying to do control it there as well. But I'm not as familiar with the way the disease was transmitted there. I do know that at this point, we don't just have transmissions coming from China. We have what's called community infection. And what that means is that people in our communities now are coming down with this who have no known history of contact with anyone that traveled from China. And that's most worrisome, because it's indicating that the virus is in our communities, and that is the reason why for the next 15 days, authorities all over this country are asking people to do what you're doing, pretty much. And only essential businesses are being allowed to have people travel to go to work, and they are being encouraged to take every precaution as well.
And finally, sort of a personal question, but I know a lot of people are struggling with it. I live on the third floor here. I am expecting to get some drugs that we ordered that that I need to stay alive, if you will. What are my dangers for walking down the three flights that I have to walk? It's a fairly close hallway to pick up my drugs and come upstairs. What would you recommend on my little journey downstairs?
Okay, first of all, hold on to the handrail. And if it's a common shared handrail, you have two choices. You either happen to have a handy rubber glove, or you, as a community service, when you're on your way back up, you swab it with a disinfectant wipe. That's number one. But do pay attention that you don't fall on the stairs. Second, it is not true that this can be airborne. However, it can be detected in the air for a short period of time after someone has sneezed. And if the air that you sneezed into contains particulate pollution, again, 50 times smaller than a human hair, then the live virus particle can stay suspended in the air as long as the particles are. But assuming that people are not sneezing in your hallway, I would simply say be careful going up and down the stairs, as you would do for any person who's elderly. And the other thing I would say is that the CDC, and there are these daily calls now with health departments, and in one of the recent ones, they were talking about the value of zinc. You can take zinc in many different forms, zinc gluconate, lozenges. At worst case, you can simply take a plain old zinc pill. They do not taste very good if they're not a lozenge. And suck on it and try to do it while you're reclined, of course, without choking, because the rhinovirus, rhino for the word nose, and the coronavirus, named for its shape, tend to live in the back of the throat. So if you can bathe that area with zinc, zinc has been shown to be toxic to the rhinovirus and appears to be toxic to the coronavirus. When I say appears to, let me stress that we are all flying blind here, but from data that have been discussed now by healthcare practitioners, it does look like zinc is effective. And the other thing that I will share with your listeners, which is an anecdote, but I think it's pretty interesting, is a report from Dr. Peter Cheng, a family practice physician in Shanghai, of a family of five. One person developed COVID-19 and became very sick. Four adults took care of that person and had a lot of exposure as a consequence. Those four adults were taking prophylactic doses of vitamin C, 2 to 6 grams a day with food. None of them got sick with the virus, and the person who was hospitalized with it, in China right now, half of the people that go into intensive care don't come out. This person that was diagnosed and was in intensive care and on a respirator, her family insisted that they give her intravenous vitamin C over the doctor's objections, but they said, look, we'll do it if you feel so strongly about it. She survived, and all of the family members have survived without any sign of disease in the four of them. Now, this is an anecdote, but under the circumstances, I think it's important for people to think about this as a possibility. The worst case, quite frankly, is that you give yourself expensive urine. And the best case is that maybe this will turn out to be useful, because there is actually a large body of research indicating that vitamin C in different forms at different times is now being studied at the NIH for its ability to find and snuff out cancer cells as well as viral cells. And that research has to go on, but while it's going on, I think it's really important that people understand this may be something worth doing, and it's relatively inexpensive, a straightforward thing to do.
So it's sort of think zinc and vitamin C as a possibility for restraining or holding off the virus.
I would think as a no regrets kind of policy for the most part. The worst thing is it gives you a funny taste in your mouth, and if you take too much, you have to go to the bathroom too often. But that seems a small price to pay for avoiding this exposure. And I think that it's important to realize that while children are not likely to die from this, they can get it. And there's been reports in the Lancet, I think just this week, March 12th, as a matter of fact, on a small number of cases of children who ended up having to be hospitalized for this, so that it is possible that kids can get this. Just think of it as this is the worst flu in the world right now. That's what this is. It's not like the ordinary flu, and we have to take every precaution. And the habits that we're trying to encourage people to do now, hand washing long enough to sing happy birthday twice, and after you wash your hands, drying with a paper towel or a clean towel that only you use, that you don't share with anybody. Those are some habits that we're going to help us. If we stick with those habits, we're going to have a much less of a problem with flu coming on next year. And we have a lot of things we don't know here. But one of the things we do know is that this country can pull together. And I'm pleased to see that Governor Newsom and the president are working together, because that's what's needed. The time for name-calling is long gone, and we have to pull together to make sure that the United States does not become like Italy.
Is there anything else that I may have forgotten to ask, or you think my audience should know about in this context? And by the way, this idea of we could be locked down for a lot more than 10, 15 days. People are talking May. Some people are talking 6 months. So what about this idea of it roaring back, it just sort of dissipating and then coming back? What about all that?
You know, I wish I had some wisdom to offer you about those. I think, again, we're dealing with just so many things that we do not fully understand. But I will say this. If we can get on top of it now, if we can slow the rate of new cases now, then I think we're going to be in a good position to avoid this lockdown for many months. I really think that I can foresee that could happen. And we need to learn lessons from what's happened in other countries, because if we do not learn from the mistakes that others have made, we will make the same mistakes and we will end up in a worse situation. But we do not have the same population density. We do not have the same horrific patterns of air pollution or dangerous patterns of smoking and poor sanitation. So we have a lot of good things we can rely on here. But we do have to recognize that this virus is highly infectious, and the best way to protect yourself and your family is to avoid getting exposed in the first place right now. And if that means that we stay under close quarters for 2 weeks or a month, it seems like a small price to pay. You know, the economy right now is in great trouble, and there is an automatic stop that is put into the stock market when it starts to fall too fast. And that causes the market to take a pause for 15 minutes. You can do that with the economy. You can put in this automatic stop. It's called a circuit breaker for the economy. We don't have a circuit breaker for the virus. The closest thing we have to a circuit breaker is to get people to stay indoors, not go out except for essential things, and look after their neighbors, call them up on the phone and ask what they need, so that we can help each other to avoid spreading this highly infectious agent to our children, our grandchildren, and our parents and grandparents.
Profound shortage of respirators, other equipment that we need. Does that worry you?
Of course. There's, you know, of course. And, you know, I'll have to say one thing. The idea that all of this problem that we face today was caused by regulations that were set in place, four years ago by the previous administration, is poppycock, nonsense, to use a polite word. The reality is we've had more than enough time to prepare for this, and we did not adequately prepare for this. And so I'm glad to see that we're bringing in the military ships, which will take the patients who do not have this virus and put them there so they can be away from sick people. I'm glad to see these things happening now, but we lost precious time early on, and we need to make that up now by taking this very seriously at this time.
The president gives himself a 10. What would you give him?
I don't grade presidents very
okay.
well.
Okay. I didn't mean to ask you that political question.
That's okay.
But
I'm just, you know, it's quite obvious to anyone in public health that I would not give him a passing grade in the past. However, I would give him passing grades right now because he's doing what he should have done in the first place. The only problem is he still is saying things that aren't true. Like just this morning, he said, we're going to have tests available for everybody. And just this afternoon, the head of the Seattle hospital said, we don't have reagents. Those are the things you need in order to evaluate whether the swab has a virus on it. He said, we're going to have this drive-up kits, and we're going to be able to swab yourself. Well, yes, we should have it, but we do not. And I think sometimes there's wishful thinking that goes on here, almost magical thinking. And we're not going to get out of this with magical thinking. We're going to get out of this by paying attention to science and paying attention to math and treating our neighbors as we want to be treated.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. But I want to thank you so much, Dr. Devra Davis. She is the president of the Environmental Health Trust. They carry out cutting-edge research to understand and reduce environmental health risks. We thank you for spending this time. A very informative interview. And please take care of yourself. And I'll do my best to do the same.
And you
thank
as well.
Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye now. And well, that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints. We did not get to what's going on at the border, but we know that the president's plan to shut it down today didn't happen. There's a lot of resistance. We're going to see if we can reach our good brother Camilo Perez Bustillo tomorrow. We couldn't seem to get to him today. There's a lot more to talk to you about. We're also going to be taking a look at what's happening in Myanmar and Bangladesh in terms of the ongoing genocide there and the implications for this virus right in the middle of a genocide. There's a lot more to understand, a lot more to look at, but we urge you to be careful, take care of yourself, love the one you're with and all the folks around you, and love them enough to not put them in danger. Thanks for listening.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
In the next 70 years, the people will rise up and the gun lobby will collapse. No-nonsense gun legislation will take hold, and school shootings, suicide, domestic violence, and murder rates will evaporate. More common sense and less need for thoughts and prayers. In the next 70 years, your fiercely independent radio station will be here to cover it for you.
For you. For you.
94.1 FM, KPFA.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 KPFA. K248BR in Santa Cruz and online worldwide at kpfa.org.